Hello and welcome to page 44. We're talking about the book of Revelation. I should say we're starting to talk about the book of Revelation. On this page, we're going to do some basic overview, and then in the next couple of chapters, we're going to get more into it. I'm spending more time in the book of Revelation than I'm spending in the other letters because it's mysterious. And to be honest, it's misunderstood in the Catholic world generally. I misunderstood it. I was right there along with you. And in diving into it and learning it, I just feel convicted that it's good for us to understand and to know. The other letters are a lot more straightforward. You can tell who is writing, who is being written to, they're being reprimanded or instructed. But the book of Revelation has so many visions and, you know, different symbols and things like that. The author, John, the beloved disciple, is assuming that you know so much about the Old Testament, but he doesn't directly quote it. This is not Matthew writing in quotes saying, this is exactly what I'm referring to. This is John, and he's kind of all over the place, theologically amazing, but he's assuming that you're super familiar with the Old Testament in order to pick up on what he's putting down. And if we're not super familiar with the Old Testament, we miss a lot of things. The book of Revelation is largely about the Catholic Mass. And if we miss that, then we miss a lot of things. So anyways, let's get into it and kind of give, as usual, like a 10,000 foot view. So this is written by John the Beloved. This is written before the falling of the temple in 70 AD, but we're not entirely sure exactly when it's written. People say around 68 AD, so close to the falling of the temple. Okay, and this is written by John when he is near the end of his life. He, unlike all the other disciples, does not die. Sorry, apostles, not disciples. Apostles means the 12 who followed him. Disciples means a general, larger group of people who followed him and were students of him. So John the Apostle, he stayed at the foot of the cross when none of the other apostles did. They all fled, including Peter, who betrayed him. So John is like awarded, in a sense, thanked for this faithfulness by not having to die a martyr. He does get persecuted. He, I guess, gets boiled by oil, but he doesn't die. But he doesn't die a martyr. He dies from old age. So that's like a gift and a blessing to John. If you actually want to look at the end of John's gospel, he actually hints at that. He says, you know, there's a rumor that spread around that he might not have to die. So anyways, go check that out. But let's get into the actual 10,000 foot view here. Okay, so it's written by John, and it's written in 68 AD, and it is a letter, but it's also a prophetic book. It uses a bunch of visual prophecy, not spoken prophecy. Okay, so a lot of the prophetic books use spoken prophecy, meaning the prophet opens up his mouth and speaks, and it sounds kind of eloquent, and this is the message from the Lord. But some of the prophetic books also use visual prophecy, like the book of Daniel, Ezekiel, Zechariah. There's all kinds of visual oddities, if you will, that are in this book, and they all mean something. So the vision that Daniel sees of the beasts means something. As a matter of fact, all of these books would be considered prerequisites to really reading Revelation well. So I'll guide you through showing you how they relate to Daniel, Ezekiel, and Zechariah. But John is assuming you're intimately familiar with these three books because he like offhandedly mentions it. Things that are like, especially the beasts that are mentioned in Daniel. If it helps to think about it this way, it'd be like somebody in the 21st century offhandedly quoting Taylor Swift. You know, you're at a birthday party for a 22-year-old and somebody's like, I'm feeling 22. And you're assuming that this is so obvious that you don't have to say, that's from the song 22 by Taylor Swift, by the way. Everyone's like, duh. So John is writing and his things are obvious to Jews and not obvious to us. That's kind of the same vibe we're getting here, okay? Note, this book is not a futuristic book, okay? It's not primarily a book of cryptic future messages to decode. It's not about Russia. The word Antichrist is not in it. There has been a lot of damage done in the modern world by misunderstanding and widely promulgating a misunderstood version of Revelation where it's like, this must be about China and Russia. Like, this book did not skip 2,000 years of history and say, it doesn't apply to you. This applies to 2026. Like, it's not like that. So there are futuristic elements, but this is a letter book, okay? This is also not mainly historical. A lot of scholars today, non-Catholic scholars, will also claim that this describes the seven time periods of the world, okay? And we are like in the Ephesus time period. No, we're in the Lacedonia time period, you know, and they try to match time periods to the seven churches mentioned. That's also doesn't make any sense because every single one of these scholars comes up with a different subjective list of what time period we're in. There's a third thing that it's not. So it's not primarily futuristic. It's not historical and it's not preterist, which means it's just a history of the first century. This book is like any other book in the Bible. It is about the time in which it was written, and we can apply it to today. In the same way that we use allegorical, anagogical, moral lenses in any book of the Bible and apply it to today, we apply the book of Revelation to today. So yes, there is, and we will get into it, a vision of the end times, the wedding, okay? The wedding between the bride and the bridegroom. But besides that point, this is really about the John writing to the seven churches that exist in Asia Minor about things that will happen to them in their future. Soon. So right now in 2026, those things have already happened. Okay, they have passed. They have passed shortly after 68 AD. Okay. But this book is, we read it like any other book in the New Testament in its own historic context, but applied to our lives. And John, essentially all the books, the other gospels touch on the end times. Mark 12, Matthew 24, Luke 21. These are chapters in the gospels that talk about the end times. And John doesn't have a chapter like that in his gospel. So the book of Revelation is almost like John's gospel end times chapter that he does not have in his gospel. That makes sense? So we have to kind of take the emphasis off of the end times and put the emphasis on the actual recipients of John's letter, which is the seven churches of the modern day Turkey. Okay, so the full title of this book is The Revelation of John. It's been reduced down to Revelation. We just call it Revelation. But that's fitting because Revelation and Apocalypse, by the way, same word, just means unveiling. Okay? And the book unveils the bride at the wedding at the end of it. Okay? So if you hear this book is an apocalyptic book, it's the Apocalypse of John. That doesn't mean end times. Okay? That means unveiling. It's the same word as Revelation. And it is a record of visions that John sees when he's on the island of Patmos off the coast of Ephesus. He is exiled there during a persecution where Peter and Paul die. Peter is crucified upside down. Paul is beheaded. John escapes. He's exiled to this island of Patmos. And there he has this vision and he writes it down. Now, the book does bounce around a little bit like a movie with flashbacks. There's vivid stories that don't take place in chronological order. It's kind of like the movie Interstellar. But generally, it's messages to local churches and a blessing that John writes to those reading them aloud to hear. Okay? Especially at the very opening, you can open up the book of Revelation and it starts as any other letter does. It's John to the churches. And he actually blesses the person who is reading this out loud, like the lector and the congregation. And he blesses those who are hearing this read out loud. Now, something that really trips us up in this book to make us think it's all creepy and weird and futuristic. I mean, to be honest, I'm with you. I open it up. I'm like, what the heck is happening? I can't make heads or tails of it. Is that there's lots of numbers and colors at play. A lot of literary device. Okay, let's run through a couple of those. The number seven. We've talked about this in the Old Testament course, but seven, the number seven is the same as the Hebrew word for oath. Same word, oath, covenant, seven. So the seven spirits God references and the seven bowls and the seven seals, lots of sevens. They are talking about God completing and fulfilling covenants with all the sevens. Okay. Covenant, oath, and God is fulfilling, completing. There's also fours. The number four. In Leviticus 26, God describes his punishment upon the people of Israel when they break covenant with him in four cycles of seven. Okay? So when you see a four, four means a reference to the Mosaic covenant where God told the people that he'd punish them if they disobeyed. So it's punishment four times, sevenfold. And four generally means universal, referring to north, south, east, west. So if you see seven, you're thinking, okay, God is completing something, covenant fullness. And if it's a four, it's punishment. And it's four times sevenfold, okay? I know you're like, what? We don't have to totally grasp this to get the gist of it, okay? Remember, we're just awareness that this is a literary device is already a huge step up. Even if you're not completely clear on exactly what the four or the seven means, we will apply these literary devices as we see them throughout the book, okay? Another number that we show up, that shows up here is threes. Threes in the Bible is the perfect number. It's repeated here as like the third day, 3 days before the covenant on Sinai they prepared, 3 day journey to the desert appears multiple times, 3 days in the tomb till the resurrection. So when you see the number three, it's not so much that it's literally three things, it's that it's the perfect number. Same with 10, you'll see 10,000s or 1,000, you know, like increments of 10. 10 is an idiom for a multitude for many. So if they say there's 10,000 people there, it doesn't mean there's literally 10,000. It means there's a lot, okay? Now let's move to some colors. White means purity, or it might mean victory, or it might mean wisdom. Think about the elders with their white heads, okay? So if Jesus has white hair, it's about his wisdom, not about him actually having white hair, okay? It's a symbol. In the same way, red means violence, blood, black means darkness, sin, fear, and purple means royalty. So when you see the people clothed in white, this is good. It's purity, it's victory. If you see people clothed in black, ooh, it's bad. It's darkness, sin, fear. If you see people clothed in purple, you think that's a king. Two last idioms to just wet your whistle with is the land and the sea. Okay, the sea, generally speaking at this time, the sea is a Hebrew idiom for the Gentiles, and the land is the chosen people. So it's like the earth coming up out of the waters, created out of the sea. In creation, there's the sea first, and then the waters are pulled up out of it. It's like the sea is chaos, danger, the Gentiles, and the land, the chosen people, are like pulled up to be separated, different. Okay, so last quick note is that the earth here, when it says earth, think land. Okay, when we think earth, we're not thinking of the blue sphere, earth planet, because they don't have any concept of that. So sometimes, you know, as you're reading Revelation, you're thinking on the earth. It's like they really are just talking about on the land. They're talking about dirt, ground. It kind of changes the meaning of it when you substitute the word earth in for land. They really are only talking about land here. They are in, you know, 68 AD. There also is a lot of references back to other covenants. So if you know the other covenants pretty well, you should be able to see them kind of peeking through. Seed and root of David is often referred to. And it's because this is about the final covenant, the marriage between the bride and Jesus in the New Jerusalem in heaven. And so the other covenants are all in the book of Revelation. But, you know, according to the number 7, God is like completing and filling them. Okay. So up at the top right of your page, you've got Jesus with 7 lampstands. That's just going to be an image in Revelation. So I threw it up there for your enjoyment. But now we're going to get into hopefully a concise and also clear plot and chapter guide to show you what is going on throughout the book of Revelation. I'm not going to claim to be the foremost expert in this. Absolutely not. But I have read a bunch and I've listened to a bunch, and I can at least walk you through the basics and point out like basic landmarks. Okay. You might get yourself into the weeds of a chapter and say, what does this exact line mean? And I might not be the person to answer that for you, but I'm at least going to give you, I'll be your guide walking through the mountains. I'll be able to point out, this is this type of tree. This is a river. That's a lake. This is generally what's going on. Hopefully by the end of this little study on Revelation, you're going to feel more confident in the Catholic teaching of Revelation. You're going to see how it connects to the Mass. You're going to see that there are futuristic elements, but it's mostly a letter to the churches. And hopefully you're going to feel a little bit more like confident. But as always, I recommend that you go read it yourself, alongside this. And you don't just take my word for it, but you read it from the primary source. Okay, see you on the next page.